Hi, my name's Gary King, and aside from being a programming director for several networks and hosting a JFK show with Dr. James Fesser, there is another side to me that I'd like to share. I'm a musician and have an acoustic album out that is completely all acoustic instruments. I've got Earl Ciano, one of the most prominent keyboard players in New Orleans. We've got Greg Finsley, is as New Orleans as it gets. So if you want to hear something that is absolutely not mainstream music, it is completely independent label, then it's Gary King, Sometimes Less Is More. So here's a cut off my acoustic album, and then our band Swamp, which is about to release a new album. So stay tuned. So here's a cut off the acoustic album called Whales. Just say or type into your phone, Gary King, Sometimes Less Is More on iTunes. It'll pop right up and support true independent music.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful, I'm the patsy, and we will be.
Ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where for the first hour, I want to review some current political events, including, of course, the third observance of the running of the Boston Marathon since the bombing, where I'm not surprised to find stories like the very first shown here on our slide, Boston Marathon bombing survivor to run this year's race with prosthetic leg. The Wisconsin State Journal had a story about it. Bombing survivors will run Boston on prosthetics, all very touching, all public relations, none of it true. I anticipated, because it was an earlier story in USA Today by a fellow named Joseph Murphy, who claims to be an assistant professor, that he was there that day assisting with the medical care, but none was needed. we have here, by way of brief review, though I do not believe those who are regular viewers of the show would be taken in, we have from a video police in the background calling out on bullhorns, "This is a drill. This is a drill." We have tweets from the Boston Globe about a bomb being set off for the benefit of bomb squad activities. And when it happens, we have smoke, we have noise. And look here, through the smoke, you see there are some people lying on the ground, some of whom are missing arms or legs. But what's missing? There is no blood. Here's another. There is no blood. Now, Lorraine Day, who was for 25 years in charge of trauma surgery for San Francisco General Hospital, has observed it is a physiological impossibility. It can't happen that you would have legs or arms blown off by an explosion and there be no blood. That means this isn't real. This is a scenario. This is staged. This is fake. In addition, when the blood shows up, it isn't real blood. It's too bright. It came out of tubes. It's Hollywood blood. Contrast with the insert, real blood from a bomb in Cairo, because real blood deoxygenates and turns dark red. Now, notice the fellow near the center with a circle. He has a false prosthesis with a leg extension on it, which has been attached under the smoke. I'll go back and show you. He's keeping his head up off the ground because people spit on the ground, but I hardly think one would show such delicacy if they'd actually had their legs blown off. So I go back here and look on the left. You see his bone, the leg extension up there. It's been attached by this man in the hoodie with dark glasses. He's holding it up above a black woman's head, but there is no blood. Here's the earlier. This is when it's taking place. The man in the hoodie attaching the false prosthesis. I mean, this is embarrassingly bad. With injuries like this, by the way, you'd be unconscious in 1 minute and dead in 2 from the bleed out. But it takes a while. And they eventually put him into a wheelchair and rush him off, as I'm going to explain. I understood about the fake blood, Hollywood blood, but I was simply dumbfounded when Nathan Foulkes, a Hollywood producer and director, suggested to me that it had actually been done using a smoke machine. And would you believe we found the smoke machine illustrated here? I was so stunned that I put a photograph of it on the back of the cover of the book, and nobody died in Boston either. Instead of leaving him prone on his back, applying tourniquets, they picked him up and put him in a wheelchair, which is the wrong thing to do. Incidentally, if it had been real, he would have already been dead. And here I have Carlos Arredondo, whom Nathan Foulkes identified as an actor he cast in one of his own films in a cowboy hat. Carlos has made trips around the country for big bucks, being praised as a hero. But he's simply an actor in a scene who was hired. Here's a second of the same guy who's supposed to be Jeff Bauman. Now, we know the first one here is actually a fellow named Voight, Nick Voight, who lost his legs in Afghanistan, but also one of his fingers. So Nick Voight has 9 fingers and his legs cut off below the knee. The second Jeff Bauman shows up at the Boston Bruins game just 19 days later. He's got 10 fingers and his legs cut off above the knee. Now, Dr. Stan Monteith, with whom I had a most cordial conversation on his show, Dr. Stan is an orthopedic surgeon who has performed amputations of this kind, and he explained to me that it takes 3 months just to recover from the amputation, another 3 to learn to get along without your legs. But here we have a very cheerful Jeff Bauman, number 2, in a Boston's Bruins game, waving a flag just 19 days later. Turns out that Gary King had the keen eye to discern there was yet a third Jeff Bauman shown here, who again has all 10 fingers, but now he has no legs at all, not even any thighs. and how appropriate that he should be wheeled out by Carlos Arredondo. These guys must be feeling pretty good about it because they've got away with this elaborate deception and received big bucks for it. The Justice Department has issued $8.4 million grant for Boston Marathon victims. But there weren't any victims. These were amputee actors who were hired to play roles. The smoke came from a machine. They made some noise, but as a former artillery officer in the Marine Corps, I can assure you these were not powerful to have done anyone any harm. The blood came out of tubes, which is why I subtitled the book, State-Sponsored Terrorism with Hollywood Special Effects. I'm glad to report that it's just received a very thoughtful review online. You can find it and American Free Press has done a two-page review as well. So this is a very nice review. Check it out. You can find it from the coffee coaster. The coffee coaster. Brian is his name. Now, for the more serious news of the day, we've had this problem with the government covering up the 28 pages that were not released from the 9/11 report. We know that they include information about the Saudis helping to finance the events of 9/11. But the government has been covering it up. And now it turns out that Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, is threatening to sell assets to the tune of $750 billion if Congress passes a 9/11 bill that would release information about Saudi Arabia's participation and allow Americans to sue foreign governments. We have this in an interview, which runs just a few minutes, which was one of the most interesting occasions I've ever been called upon by the international press to offer my response to a news story. So let's take a look right now.
Riyadh has warned Washington that it will sell off hundreds of billions of dollars worth of assets in the U.S. if Congress passes a bill which allows the Saudi government to be held responsible in connection with the 9/11 attacks. Saudi Arabia says it will be forced to sell up to $750 billion in treasury securities and other assets in the U.S. in order to prevent them from being frozen by American courts. U.S. government officials have reportedly lobbied with senators to block the bill's passage. They have warned Congress of diplomatic and economic fallout from the legislation. President Barack Obama, however, is expected to visit Riyadh next week. It's not clear yet whether the issue will be discussed during the visit. Right, to get some perspective, let's go to James H. Fetzer, Professor, University of Minnesota, Duluth. Professor Fetzer, it's good to have you with us on the news bulletin. Now, essentially, doesn't this warning by Saudis in a way, in a very clear-cut way, mean that the U.S. government and its foreign policy as a whole have been taken hostage, this time not only to the pro-Zionist lobby, that is, but also to the Saudis?
Well, it's a form of blackmail, without any doubt. I mean, this threat to sell off this vast amount of assets. It's fascinating how the lies of the American government are catching up with them. Remember, 15 of the 19 alleged terrorists aboard the planes were from Saudi Arabia. None of them were from Iran. We know the 28 pages that have yet to be released concern Saudi funding for 9/11. The Saudis weren't the principal players because 9/11 was brought to us by the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, who had come from the Project for a New American Century, most of whom were dual U.S.-Israeli citizens and the Mossad. I think Saudi Arabia is alarmed because we impose these sanctions on Iran when it wasn't even developing nuclear weapons and we knew it. So that here is a case where, in fact, there is evidence that Saudi Arabia had a role, even though it was not a major role in 9/11. So they're worried that they may be subjected to sanctions themselves.
Now, Professor, the Saudis have so far gone away with most of the problems they've been creating for the region and well beyond. Now, if the U.S. actually buckles and surrenders in this case, should it not ring the alarm bells in Washington as well as in other world capitals in the West about the potential and actual threats that the Saudi regime is currently posing to their independence?
Absolutely. I mean, this is fascinating because it threatens to blow apart the whole 9/11 cover-up. Families of the September 11 victims have used the courts to try to hold members of the Saudi royal family, Saudi banks and charities liable because what the plaintiffs charged was Saudi financial support for terrorism. But the role of Israel and of the United States, especially the neocons, was overwhelmingly greater. Many remember that during the time all American aircraft were shut down. They were forced to land. The U.S. government flew members of the Saudi royal family out of the United States and back to Saudi Arabia. This special treatment is now glaring in the wake of this development.
Now, Professor, very briefly, this threat as posed by the Saudis in and by itself can be seen by many, at least, as some sort of a guilty verdict against them in the case of the 9/11 attacks. What's your feeling there?
Well, they did have a role, but it was relatively minor because the whole event was orchestrated by the CIA and the neocons who had moved into the Department of Defense from the Project for a New American Century and wanted to create a traumatic catalyzing event, which they called a new Pearl Harbor, to reverse American foreign policy so that we would become engaged in wars in the Middle East to defeat the modern Arab states that served as a counterbalance to Israel. This whole event sprang from the fertile mind of Benjamin Netanyahu, and it's just tragic that the American government became complicit. The Saudis had a minor role, but it threatens to expose and blow apart the whole charade.
All right. Appreciate it. Professor James H. Fetzer, University of Minnesota, Duluth, joining us.
It was a great pleasure for me to be called upon to offer that interview. And I indeed have given a second for Press TV, which is the Iranian news service. I actually meant to say that of the 19 hijackers, 15 were from Saudi Arabia, none were from Iraq. But because I was being interviewed by Iranian news service, I mentioned Iran instead, which is fitting, however, because the sanctions we were imposing upon Iran were actually completely inappropriate. They had no basis or justification, and because they qualify as forms of collective punishment, they actually constitute war crimes under Article 33 of the Geneva Convention of 1949. So here you see the cover of the interview for CIA Mossad coordinated September 11th attack scholar. Strong evidence substantiates this was a very sophisticated intel operation involving coordination between the CIA and the Mossad, who are really the only two intelligence agencies in the world that could have pulled it off. And in this case, they were working together. Now, I think Americans are becoming quite outraged because Barack Obama has been siding with Saudi Arabia, promising to block a bill exposing the Saudi role in the 9/11 attacks. So here we have him siding with the Saudis rather than with the American people. I don't think this is going to go down well. I believe it's going to spill into the election and that we're going to see much more discussion about this in the future, because Hillary has been seeking to defend Obama. And I think that for this and other reasons, we're going to find that that's not going to go down very well with the public. In addition, we've had recent question raised about the presence of tritium at 9/11 Ground Zero, all related to this, because, you know, Senator Bob Graham of Florida had drawn attention to the 28 pages. The very fact that 9/11, that the World Trade Center location is referred to as Ground Zero, fits, of course, because it's the location below the point of detonation of an atomic or a nuclear bomb. And in fact, that is what we have discovered. The scholars with whom I have been collaborating, including Jeff Prager, Dr. Ed Ward, Don Fox, Dennis Camino, and a host of others, presented a mass of evidence at the Vancouver hearings held in June of 2012, for example, that this had been a nuclear event. I mean, look at that photograph. Does anyone possibly believe that could be the result of a collapse? Actually, a collapse wasn't even physically possible. It appears to have been done with a very sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes, which is why the USGS, U.S. Geological Survey dust samples from 35 locations in Manhattan revealed the presence of elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event, including barium, strontium, cesium, uranium, lithium, lanthanum, and tritium. So I am optimistic that this faux pas by the government of rushing to the aid of Saudi Arabia is not only going to enrage the American people for a president who's looking up for a foreign nation that is really a despicable regime that has no respect for human rights and not sticking up for the American people. I don't think that is going to play well. A fascinating development in New York City that may have been missed by those who aren't paying attention. But Bernie Sanders was introduced at a crowd of about 27,000 people just a couple weeks ago. A fellow by the name of a healthcare activist and physician by the name of Paul Song, I think, spoke particularly striking words. He said, "Medicare for all," which of course Bernie champions, "will never happen if we continue to elect corporate Democratic whores or beholden to Big Pharma and the private insurance industry instead of us." Bernie, of course, had to disavow the language. But I think with crystal clarity, Paul Song summed up the case against Hillary Clinton as a corporate Democratic whore. Clinton, of course, has been paid vast sums by Wall Street and these brokerage firms for giving speeches, which is a thinly veiled form of bribery. She's been given $225,000 speeches, enough to add up to over $3 million, where information about one she gave in October of 2013 has been revealed. "It was pretty glowing about us," one person who watched the event said. "It's so far from what she sounded like as a candidate now. It was like a rah-rah speech. She sounded more like a Goldman Sachs managing director." Now, Hillary is withholding those speeches, and I think it's going to increasingly count against her. Bernie Sanders, during their debate, this was just last Thursday, was simply spectacular. He really had the better of Hillary. And I was simply astonished, nevertheless, that the first poll I discovered with not quite 5,000 participants gave Bernie the victory by 92% to 8%. That is stunning. So the following day, I found a larger poll with 50,000 just to confirm my belief that it had been by a vast margin. And this larger poll gave it to Bernie by 84% to 14%. That's really stunning. There's been considerable discussion about why Bernie did so well. And notice the question framed here from this clip. Why doesn't Clinton release the transcripts of her speeches to Goldman Sachs and put the issue to rest? Number one, why Bernie won in this analyst's opinion. Getting Hillary on the record supporting $15 an hour minimum wage. Before, she'd stopped at 12. Number two, rebuffing Clinton's attack on guns at the start of the New York debate. She assailed him for not supporting the right of the victims of Sandy Hook to sue Remington as the manufacturer of the weapon, which is ridiculous any way you want to cut it. Bernie's certainly on the right. He responded to her by saying he thought it was unfortunate that she should politicize a tragedy. But even if you assumed it had actually happened, this would be like suing an automobile manufacturer because accidents occur. It's obviously not the policy of Remington to have anyone use their weapons to shoot up a bunch of kids in a school. It did not happen. But the point is, the lawsuit's absurd on its face, and I think Hillary lost credibility over it. Third, framing her super predator's remark as a racist term. This is a phrase she used in the past. It was clearly intended to refer to blacks who are supposed to be lawbreakers, and it is indeed a racist term. Fourth, forcing Clinton into a corner, really a box on the Goldman Sachs transcripts. Now the pressure is elevating. When she finally releases it, there's going to be a huge amount of attention to every word, and you're going to find there's no criticism whatsoever of the predatory practices of Wall Street. She's there as a cheerleader. Very embarrassing. The people are going to see through her as what Dr. Song described as a corporate democratic whore, framing the issue of climate change as a threat to national security. Bernie Sanders was very clever to give it that twist. There is a consensus among most experts that it's bona fide. We see an awful lot of signs of changing weather patterns around the world. And I'm inclined to believe it. So, you know, I think Bernie got the better of her there, too. Now, here's a fascinating commentary on President Hillary getting to the point that talking about her being a Teflon candidate because in her campaign for president, she's escaped damage from major scandals, any one of which would destroy a politician, an ordinary politician, ordinarily. She's accepted mafia bribes in the form of speaking fees from financial organizations and corporations. She's under investigation for misuse of classified data, an offense for which many whistleblowers are in prison. She's survived the bombing of Libya, her creation of a failed Libyan state that is today a major source of terrorist jihadists and the Benghazi controversy. She has survived charges that as Secretary of State, she arranged favors for foreign interests in exchange for donation to the Clinton Foundation. You have to ponder this. We're talking about a corporate Democratic whore. The Inspector General of the Department of State, for example, has observed that Clinton emails had intelligence from our most secretive classified programs. This is completely shocking. General Petraeus was removed from being head of the CIA, for which he was qualified to an exemplary degree for a very minor variation, a fraction of what she committed here. It's an outrage. And here the State Department has announced it has had to withhold some 22 Clinton emails and 7 strings because they were classified top secret. So these documents were not merely redacted or blocked out. They were completely withheld. One source not authorized to speak suggested the intel agencies are operating on the assumption there are more copies of the Clinton emails out there, and even releasing a partial email would provide enough clues to trace back to the original, which could allow the identification of special access programs intelligence. Let me tell you, special access programs, SAPs, are the most highly classified in American intelligence. Get this. It turns out her emails show she lied to us about Libya. She was part and parcel of the demonization of Muammar Gaddafi, who is actually sharing the wealth of Libya with the Libyan people. National health care, national public education. If you had a medical problem, couldn't be dealt with in Libya, they would fly you and a friend or relative anywhere in the world at all expense paid by the government. He was giving $25,000 gifts to newly married couples. They had national warehouses. If you needed food, you could go and you would be fed. There was virtually no crime in Libya. He was creating the Great Waterworks Project that would have turned North Africa into a veritable oasis. But he was also introducing the gold dinar. And get this, it turned out Hillary's emails explain that what they were demonizing Gaddafi purely for political public relations reason as propaganda, that it was really because he was introducing the gold dinar, which the Western banking interests were worried would be a threat to them, and where France was upset that Gaddafi's influence over Africa was going to increase. So they went in with a massive NATO force and slaughtered the Libyan people, slaughtered them. The mercenaries were paid 3 times for the same body, once to kill the person, once to chop him up, once to burn the body. Rape was going on totally out of control. And now we have nothing but chaos in Libya, which is a hotbed for terrorists. We also have hard evidence that she knew at the time that Benghazi was the terrorist attack, even though she falsely claimed that it had been precipitated by the little propaganda trailer Innocence of Muslims, which is really amateurish, but did incense many Muslims. In any case, Hillary knew it had nothing to do with that. It appears to have had to do with weapons, particularly shoulder-held missiles that can be used to shoot down commercial carriers, where Chris Stevens, the ambassador, wanted to retrieve them. He wanted to get them back. He wanted to make sure they didn't fall into the hands of the jihadists. Hillary was on the other side. And here you get a wonderful article by Robert Perry, who's one of our nation's best investigative journalists, reporting that Hillary is a neocon. Well, 9/11, as I mentioned already, was brought to us by the CIA, the neocons in the Department of Defense, who had come from the Project for a New American Century, most of whom were dual U.S.-Israeli citizens and the Mossad. The idea was to transform American foreign policy from one in which, at least officially, we never attacked any nation that had not attacked us first, to one in which we became an aggressor nation, taking out with a plan to take out the governments of seven nations in the next 5 years, beginning with Iraq and Libya, ending with Syria and Iran. Fortunately, Russia has put a halt to it, but not for lack of trying. Hillary Clinton is a neocon. She believes in wars. She glorifies in wars. After Gaddafi was killed, she paraphrased Julius Caesar and said, "We came, we saw, he died," with a cackle. This is not a good person. This is not a decent human being. And there are too many other neocons in the Obama administration, including Samantha Power at the United Nations, Victoria Nuland at the Department of State, Ash Carter as Secretary of Defense, and Susan Rice as National Security Advisor, which means it's impossible that Obama, who has surrounded him with neocons, including Hillary Clinton, is not a neocon himself. Obama's also trying to get her out of the email scandal. He's tried to convert it into a political issue. It's really embarrassing, but look how bad it is. Now, this is an observation by Bob Woodward, who was instrumental in revealing the Watergate scandal with Carl Bernstein, and they published together all the president's men. But look at this. Chris Wallace, who's doing a pretty good job now of becoming a significant interviewer, has made the following points. Obama made the following point to him about Hillary. She did not jeopardize America's national security secrets. Clearly false. Politics will not influence the outcome of the massive FBI investigation. Then what is he doing here? The Justice Department decision about possible prosecution, but Loretta Lynch is known to have close ties to Hillary Clinton. She was careless in terms of managing her emails. No, she was utterly reckless in disregard. She was derelict in her duty. It was a form of treason. The scandal needs to be put in perspective. Yeah, political perspective to save Hillary, because Hillary served her country and did an outstanding job. Ridiculous. If you believe in wars, if you believe in slaughtering the Libyan people and turning Libya into a wasteland that's now a hotbed for terrorists, then yes, she did a good job. She had never intentionally put America in any kind of jeopardy. Well, she's done it again and again. This is completely outrageous. And this indicates that Barack Obama is untrustworthy and he's a political charlatan who will say anything, do anything to benefit. In fact, the Bill Still report number 796 shows former FBI agents are so upset that they've written to James Comey, the head of the FBI, that this investigation should be carried out in a proper fashion, seeing all the signs that that is not the case. They are right. Obama is wrong. And here is a note from Governor Malloy of Connecticut insisting that the lawsuit is a good thing, the lawsuit that Hillary was defending and attacking Bernie for not. These families deserve this. The ruling is the right one. The gun industry should not have protections that no other industry in America sees. He must be very ignorant because there's all kinds of immunity for the pharmaceutical industry for producing vaccines, even if they kill large numbers of people. Danny Malloy was complicit in the Sandy Hook hoax. Check out the book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. For 425 pages of proof, 250 photographs, 13 contributors. Hillary Clinton using Sandy Hook victims as political prop just backfired completely. I'm very glad to see this happen. Bernie is a very skilled guy, it turns out. They grossly underestimated him. Nationwide, the polls are getting closer and closer and closer. There's a chance we can see some very surprising outcomes here in the near future, where the New York primary, of course, is tomorrow. And here's another judge in Connecticut who's part of the elaborate sham there, that Sandy Hook documents supposedly have come from the home, must be kept secret. Well, this is ridiculous. We have a chapter 7 in the book, and Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, with 50 photographs of them furnishing the Adam Lanza home. It appears to have been an empty house in a high-priced real estate area. It was furnished with cheap furniture, and you see them doing it different ways. Adam's room, neat. Adam's room, messy. Adam's room with a bed made. Adam's room with a bed not made. There was no printer there that could have produced the alleged monster printout, a spreadsheet of earlier mass killings. Adam Lanza appears to be a fiction, but you're not going to get a judge in the state of Connecticut to accept that, to announce it, to let it be known. Donald Trump is perfectly reasonably explaining to Fox and Friends the system is rigged, getting a lot of attention out there. He was talking about how Colorado didn't even bother to conduct a vote. They have neither a caucus nor a primary. 900,000 Republicans in Colorado were not allowed to express their opinion about who ought to be their party's nominee. Instead, all 34 votes were given directly to Ted Cruz. Here, even MSNBC's Joe Scarborough's exploded about the Democratic Party rigging their side. Look at that. Bernie gets in Wyoming 56%, Hillary 44%. But look below. Hillary gets 11 delegates. Bernie only gets 7. This is becoming outrageous. And one of the great benefits of Donald Trump entering the race is that he's exposed the chicanery of the political parties and that all of these elections are rigged. And it turns out, too, they're planning to continue Trump of delegates in Indiana and Wyoming, too. And the anti-Trump people are gloating over it. So these are states in which there will be no caucus and no primary, where the GOP executives are simply allocating the delegates to Ted Cruz. It's a shame. It's an embarrassment. Here's an interesting interview that Donald did with Wolf Blitzer a few years back in 2013, talking about how all these wars in the Middle East were shameful. They were precipitated by lies, such as we being told that there were weapons of mass destruction. This is one of three big issues on which Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders stand together. The first and most important is on trade agreements. They're both opposed to NAFTA and the TPP, which, by the way, would subvert the Constitution of the United States. It creates a panel of corporate attorneys who can overrule the laws or statutes or even the Constitution of any of the 14 Pacific Rim nations that are going to be subsumed thereby. They both agreed that the wars in the Middle East were a tremendous mistake. Bernie voted against the war in Iraq. Hillary voted for it. And they are at one as non-interventionists, meaning they believe in the selective application of military force, unlike Hillary Clinton, who is a neocon and a hawk. Hillary is all for wars, aggressive wars. Her colleagues, fellow neocons, have been seeking to precipitate a war with Russia, which may well come. And Donald and Bernie are both in favor of the Second Amendment. Hillary is out to undermine it. It's completely outrageous, because if the war should occur with Russia, then Washington and New York City will be the first to be taken out. We'll be living in a Jericho-type post-nuclear scenario. Communities that cannot defend themselves are going to be at the mercy of marauding gangs that want to rape, to loot, and pillage. This is a terrible idea, to take weapons away from the American people. There's much more to be said about that. just ponder the case. I went on the radio on the 5th when we had the actual election taking place here in Wisconsin to explain to the talk show host, Mitch Hank, shown here on the left, why the election appeared to be rigged. I went about explaining that it appeared to have three objectives, namely to steal Wisconsin from Trump, to minimize Bernie's margin over Hillary, and to put a bimbette on the Supreme Court, who has to be a close personal friend of Scott Walker, who has appointed her completely unqualified to three different judicial appointments in 3 years. They had to rig the election to make those outcomes come true. And believe it, had noticed, I'd seen this film before when he ran against Mary Burke, who was a very qualified Democratic candidate. There was a historic turnout. There should have been a clear victory by Mary on the order of 53-47. We had Michelle Obama here twice, Barack once, the big dog Bill Clinton, and yet it turned out that the opposite of what ought to have happened took place, and it too, as in the case of this primary, was preceded by a Marquette Law School poll that made no sense at all if you understood what was going on in the mood of the electorate. Here is, I had Richard Charnin on my radio program on the right here on The Real Deal, episode 183, on stealing elections. Check it out and pay attention to Richard's explanation how five recent elections have been stolen in Wisconsin, including Scott Walker's recall election, including a Supreme Court contest between Prosser and Kloppenburg, including his contest against Mary Burke, and now including what happened here in the case of Trump versus Sanders. Here's an indication of what happened against Mary Burke. Milwaukee County is a bastion of Democratic support that start off with 80% for Mary and 20% for Walker. But as the evening grew on, it gradually closed so that the greater the number of votes that were cast, the greater the percentage that went to the Republicans. That's simply absurd in a major Democratic county. Here's what we got officially out of Wisconsin, 48-35, Cruz over Trump, 56-43, Sanders over Clinton. But the actual data is very different. Bill Still, in his report 771, explained how a precinct watcher, a woman who was in a precinct in northeastern Wisconsin, reported that the exit polls and the absentee were identical, 59-59, 28-28, 13-13, but the machine vote made a 10-point adjustment, brought Trump down to 50 and Cruz up to 38 while taking a point or two away from Kasich, and how they also shortchanged Sanders from Clinton. Indeed, there was a much more massive poll because that Marquette Law School poll had less than 1,000 participants. Look at this, of all 8 districts right before the election, massive preferences for Donald Trump on the order of 62-38, 62-38, 63-37, 52-47, on and on down to 67-33, 62-37. I mean, this thing was stolen outright, massively. And when Richard Charnin did a preliminary analysis of the Bernie versus Hillary, he concluded that Bernie should have won with between 62 and 65% of the vote. Not 68-32 is shown there. That's simply for white voters. But that overall, he should have won her by a significantly larger margin than would be reported. Well, the Boston Globe, by the way, is fairly stunning because instead of displaying its commitment to the news and to reporting, it came out with a cover page that's talking about deportations to begin. President Trump calls for tripling of ICE force. Riots continue. Markets sink as trade wars loom. U.S. soldiers refuse orders to kill ISIS families. I mean, this is really stunning stuff. Because think about it. I mean, a newspaper is supposed to be reporting the news, not making it. A newspaper is supposed to be objective and balanced, not partisan. An activist, this is truly embarrassing. But guess what? The Boston Globe has sunk very, very far. The best picture of the year at the last Academy Awards was given to Spotlight, which was a true story of how the Boston Globe uncovered the massive scandal of child molestation and cover-up within the local Catholic archdiocese. It was thorough. It was detailed. It was compelling. This is when the Boston Globe was a reputable newspaper. But just look how far it has sunk. We even have these tweets on the day of the Boston bombing. We have these tweets. Police will have controlled explosion on 600 block on Boylston Street. Officials, there will be a controlled explosion opposite the library within 1 minute, a part of bomb squad activities. This is simply horrendous. What it means is we know that the Boston police were aware that it was only a drill. They were calling out on bullhorns. This is a drill. This is a drill. We have it on video. We know that the Boston Globe was aware of breaking news. Police will have controlled explosion on 600 block on Boylston. There'll be a controlled explosion opposite the library within 1 minute as part of bomb squad activities. And 1 minute later, in front of the Boston Public Library, we have one of the two explosions, which as a former Marine Corps artillery officer, I can assure you we're not powerful enough to kill anybody. This was an elaborate fraud, and everyone knew. There are certain similarities to Sandy Hook, because at Sandy Hook, we had no surge of EMTs into the building, no string of ambulances to rush the little bodies off to hospitals where they could be pronounced to be dead or alive. No medevac helicopter was called. In Boston, the situation was the same. No surge of EMTs to the scene. No string of ambulances to rush the bodies off to hospitals where they could be treated for their injuries. No medevac helicopter was called. Get this. The police even blocked two Catholic priests from rushing to the scene to administer last rites. Remember, according to the official story, three people died and 260 were injured. Well, if you go back and look at those photographs, you're not going to find more than 12 or maybe 15 people there. Where did the 260 come from? It was all an elaborate ruse. You're being played by your own government. And the attorneys who took care of the case were well aware that Zucker and his brother Tamerlan did not plant the bombs. According to the FBI, which conducted its investigation, the two bombs that exploded were in black nylon backpacks. But neither Zucker nor Tamerlan was wearing one. Zucker's was kind of a silver gray. Tamerlan's was not black nylon. We have photographs, however, by the alternative media zooming in on Kraft International personnel who were wearing khaki trousers and black jackets, black baseball caps with a skull insignia, where the motto of Kraft is, violence does solve problems. So we also have photographs of two of them approaching the scene of one of the explosions. One is wearing a black nylon backpack with a white square stitched on it. The backpack that explodes is a black nylon backpack with a white square stitch on it. We have them rushing away, no longer wearing the black nylon backpack with a white square. In fact, a retired professor of law, John Remington Graham, was so stunned by the failure of the backpacks to match that he observed there wasn't even probable cause for an arrest, much less an indictment or a conviction in a court of law. The prosecutor had to know. The defense attorney, Judy Clark, had to know. The judge had to know. This was an elaborate show trial. We're living in Stalinist times, an age of mythology, where black is white, false is true, and the government is completely deceiving us. Let me conclude, by the way, by talking about a new report that has just appeared in the I think I may have lost to. Have you got me, Chance? Am I on the screen? Chance, am I here? Okay. I just discovered the National Enquirer has a very interesting report about the health of the candidates. And remember, the National Enquirer has revealed that Ted Cruz appears to be indulging in multiple affairs. They published about five of them. A reporter from the Washington Times was fired because he confirmed that at least two of them were accurate. In addition, we have Ashley. It turns out that his office was subscribing to the Ashley Madison adultery newsletter, and that the D.C. Madam's lawyer has asked the Supreme Court for permission to release information about the client list because it's of national significance to the public given the election taking place. Well, I spoke to Jeff Rentz about this 10 days or so ago, and Jeff told me he already had the records, and he sent me those confirming that this guy, Ted Cruz, has indeed been a patron of the D.C. madam. So, you know, he holds himself out as a paragon of moral virtue. He holds himself out as an evangelical Christian. He comes across as a preacher with moral certitude, but he's in fact a tremendous hypocrite. He's a guy who has violated the principles according to which Christians are supposed to live and conduct themselves. It's completely outrageous what's taking place with Ted Cruz. And the National Enquirer has a rather good track record. The National Enquirer printed the photograph of Gary Hart with Donna Rice sitting on his lap in front of a boat entitled Monkey Business, which said it all and took him right out of the race. It also published about John, the Democratic candidate, John Edwards, for president, who turned out to have a whole separate wife and family. I mean, his wife, Elizabeth, was a dear person, and she was dying, and here he was. He had a separate family. So you don't want to discount the National Enquirer. In fact, it's an elementary fallacy to discount a report on the basis of its source. Even if you suppose that the National Enquirer isn't always reliable, even though I'm inclined to believe it has a pretty good reliability rating, in the case of these exposés, they're concerned they don't want to be sued, and they tend to take extra precautions. Well, now they publish a very interesting review about the health of the presidential candidates, and I'm going to read to you what they say. It's really quite remarkable. Donald Trump. By any account, the Trump dozer's health is as robust as his rhetoric. In fact, the New York billionaire's physician, Dr. Harold Bornstein, declared Donald in such excellent health he could, quote, state unequivocally, he will be the healthiest individual ever elected to the presidency. The secret to Donald's good health is no secret at all. Clean living and a long history of athletic accomplishment. He long ago swore off alcohol and tobacco products. Recent physicals peg his blood pressure at 110 over 65. That's an excellent blood pressure for someone who is 69, said Dr. Art Mullen. In fact, that would be excellent reading for a 20-year-old. What I would want to know is whether this is a product of his famously Spartan lifestyle or drugs. As a boy, Donald played baseball, football, and soccer, as well as wrestling. The only problem might be a family history of Alzheimer's disease, which felled his dad at the ripe old age of 93. Well, he's far removed from that, and it's well known that the more active you keep your mind, the more activities you engage in, the less amenable you are to Alzheimer's. Now consider about Hillary Clinton. The former Secretary of State might not make it to Election Day, never mind the end of a first term. The National Enquirer has learned the 68-year-old Democrat has packed on 30 pounds while campaigning by gorging on pizza, hot dogs, tacos, and lapping up Dairy Queen as if it were going out of style. Hillary's acknowledged as much, saying that eating well on the road is nearly impossible. But her waistline is just the tip of the proverbial actuarial chart. According to a letter from her own physician, obtained by the Enquirer, Hillary suffers from hypothyroidism and takes a blood thinner, Coumadin, daily. That's alarming given Hillary's family history of stroke. Her father, Hugh Rodham, died of one in 1993, and her own history of blood clots. After Hillary suffered a concussion in 2012 in a nasty fall, doctors discovered a potentially fatal blood clot near her brain called a transverse sinus thrombosis. Coumadin is often prescribed to thin someone's blood and prevent future blood clots, said Dr. Stuart Fisher, who has not treated the former first lady. People who have had one blood clot are definitely at higher risk for others. What's more, the concussion was so serious that Hillary had to wear special glasses to combat double vision. Hillary has suffered two secret strokes, according to one source, and was ignoring doctors' orders not to take on the presidential campaign. That same source also said Hillary has blackouts, often from over-drinking, and wakes up wondering where she is and what she has done. Take that to heart. That's pretty serious stuff. What about Bernie and Ted Cruz? Bernie Sanders. While the Vermont senator has his share of age-related ailments, the trouble with Bernie is simply his age, according to doctors interviewed by the Inquirer. At 74, the Democrat is older than Ronald Reagan was during his first presidential campaign, as well as Bob Dole and John McCain during their White House runs. If Brooklyn-born Bernie wins, he'd be the oldest person ever sworn in as a first-term president in U.S. history. How old you are is something that needs to be factored into the equation when someone reaches that age, said Dr. Stephen Schlamberg, who has not treated Bernie. More alarming, the average life expectancy for an American male is now 76. 4 years, and that's for people born in 2012. When you consider people born between 1939 and 1941, like Bernie, just over 5% reach 80. Bernie's doctor acknowledged his patient has a mild case of high cholesterol and takes level thyroxine to treat hypothyroidism along with an anti-inflammatory called indomethacin. In November, Bernie had hernia surgery. He has a history of laryngitis, which he blames on acid reflux. He's had superficial skin tumors removed, as well as a vocal cord cyst. And finally, I come to Ted Cruz. When it comes to the smarmy Texas senator, the question even isn't what we know, but what he might be hiding. Of the four remaining candidates with a shot at their party's nomination, the Republican is the only one who has failed to release even a cursory summary of his health. As a physician, it certainly raises questions, especially if his colleagues have done it, said Dr. Stephen Schlamberg, a Chicago physician who has not treated Ted. The health of the candidate is something that needs to be considered by voters. What we know is that Ted, 45, doesn't appear to put nearly as much emphasis on a healthy diet as he does on goofy political antics and half-truths. The father of two once told a major newspaper he eats anything with cheese on it and that he loathes avocados, a source of good fats. He's also been known to gorge on pork chops. His wife, 43-year-old Heidi, also has a history of depression that culminated in mid-2005 when an Austin police officer found her sitting, dazed and despondent, on the side of the road. Well, that's the latest from the National Enquirer, and while it's coming from that source, I reiterate, when it comes to issues relating the candidates, they're very good. And when it comes especially to reporting on affairs by candidates, as in the case of John Edwards and Gary Hart, they are exceptional. I think that there's a mass of evidence revealing that Ted Cruz is not only hiding the truth about his health from us, but hiding the truth about his lack of fidelity to his wife, which is not going to go down well with evangelical Christians when they figure out the truth about a man who pretends to be their candidate. This is Jim Fetzer.
Hi, my name's Gary King, and I've assembled the most formidable JFK team on planet Earth. We've got Dr. James Fetzer, Larry Rivera, who is the number one researcher in the world today when it comes to new research, and we've got Don Fox, who's not afraid to look a little bit deeper than anyone else. So if you're interested in what happened to the 35th President of the United States, then I invite you to our show. It's called The New JFK Show, and it's on YouTube. Go to Gary King YouTube channel, and we've got over 90 shows archived for you there. So if you really want to know the truth, and knowing that over 9 out of 10 researchers are working the other side of the street in a sea of disinformation, I pledge to you the truth about JFK. Go to Gary King YouTube channel and find out your true history.
In Dallas, Texas, 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful, I'm just a patsy, and we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen to
a new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center. Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where I'm very pleased to have as my guest for the second hour, Melody Kramer, who's authored a new book entitled Why Lawyers Suck, about hacking the legal system. We'll show you the cover more. Let me give you a little about her background. Melody is an established innovator in the legal industry, a veteran trial lawyer, speaker, and author. She is a graduate of the University of Nebraska College of Law in Lincoln and was awarded the Order of Barristers for Excellence in the Art of Courtroom Advocacy. Since that time, she has been honing her craft as a vigorous advocate for her clients in federal, state, and tribal courts throughout the country. She began her career as a deputy public defender in rural Nebraska. She served as a special prosecutor for crimes against children and later started her own law firm in Lincoln, Nebraska. In 1999, she moved to California, where she turned her focus to complex civil litigation, often in strategic partnership with other law firms. Never deterred by the seemingly impossible, she takes on challenging some seemingly unwinnable cases with a marked level of success. Melody, I'm so pleased to have you here with me today.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
And I've been very much enjoying reading through your book. I haven't finished it, but I tell you, you have an ability to marshal complex ideas in very clear and accessible language, and you're dealing with some what many might think are difficult or abstract subject, but you bring it right home. I think you have this combination of practical experience. You're very down to earth. You're very articulate and highly intelligent, and it works. I think the book is just fascinating.
I'm glad you enjoy it. Yeah, it was a labor of love. There were things that needed to be said about the practice after 20 plus years, and I'm glad I could say those.
And you're still out in California now?
Yes, I am, in San Diego.
In San Diego. I lived 2 years in San Diego when I was a series commander at the recruit depot at the MCRD. I had 15 DIs and 300 recruits under my command. My son Brett was born in San Diego. I grew up in Southern California. I was born in Pasadena, graduated from South Pasadena High School before I went east to go to college at Princeton. Then I was commissioned in the Marine Corps, spent 4 years in the Corps. And it was during the second two of that period, from 64 to 66, I was back in San Diego. It, of course, has a reputation for the greatest weather of any city in the world.
Yes, it does. Just watch the weather every night on national news, and that little corner of San Diego is perfect.
Isn't that simply stunning?
That's why I'm here.
Yeah, very smart choice. So tell me, what brought you to write the book? And chance we can put up the cover if you got it there available.
I remember one day I had hung up the phone talking with opposing counsel, and I just I hung up the phone and I was so frustrated. I realized why people hate lawyers, because I was frustrated dealing with them, and I'm a lawyer. And it was kind of a joke in our house. My husband used to say, stop complaining about the sharks. You live in a shark tank. You chose to live in a shark tank. And I realized that lawyers just, they don't have to be horrible. But I trying to figure out why, and realize that I'm not perfect either, and probably people think that I wasn't a great lawyer in some occasions in my interactions with others. And I just kind of wanted to get down to the bottom of that and sort of rebuild, because I want to make meaningful changes in the profession.
You know, I think I find this subject especially fascinating, because during that 4 years in the Marine Corps, I pondered what I wanted to do with my life. And I was deliberating between becoming a college professor and becoming an attorney. And I figured if I went into the law, I'd become a criminal attorney, that I would feel I was my client's, servant, that if I ever lost a case, I'd feel very guilty about it, that I'd make a lot of money, but I wouldn't have any time to spend it, that if I went into college profession, that I'd have a lot of time to myself, I'd have a very intellectual life and become very productive. And it's panned out that way, where I published hundreds of articles and dozens of books. But, you know, I mean, it could have been, faithfully, if I'd gone the other way, I would have been in a very different situation. And I think I'm far happier with the decision I made. What you're doing now is giving us some insights about the shark tank, as you put it. And there's so many aspects to this I want to ask you about, including how it's in the interest of lawyers that cases should become increasingly complicated, and that they should therefore require additional, even endless number of billable hours, Melody. Would you like to comment on that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you phrase how much you get paid for something by how long you spend on it, you're going to spend a long time on it. If someone were paid to build a house by the hour that they spent, solely by the hours they spent, they would take 10 years to build a house.
Isn't that something?
It's just...
What could be more obvious, right?
Exactly. And what I put in the book, too, is for the readers to just use the example of their, you know, kids in the next room who are squabbling over, you know, whatever, a toy or whatever, and tell them, look, I'm going to pay you $5 for every 15 minutes that you continue to argue. Now, resolve this.
And you continue to argue.
They'll never stop. It's
right.
Just
seems so obvious. You're going to pay them to continue to argue.
Exactly. It seems so obvious. You need to have incentives in place in the relationship between lawyers and clients, such that there's an incentive to get it done, move on, instead of wallowing in disputes.
And Melody, am I correct that it used to be the case that a lawyer's guild had a maximum price you could charge a client, but now they've reversed it and they have a minimum price? So you have to charge at least a certain minimum, which is a way of guaranteeing that lawyers are going to get rich if they have any clients at all.
Well, there aren't actually mandatory minimums anymore, in the sense that those were held to be illegal back in the late 70s. But in terms of hourly fees, that's sort of what things switched over to. And I would say, you know, depending on the area of the country, but hourly fees that most lawyers charge are at least $200, $300, $400 and up an hour. And as smart as I'd like to think I am, I'm not worth that kind of money, 80 hours a week. I'm just not. And again, it's the mechanism. When I've switched my own billing structure to something that has incentives to get done earlier, I think differently. I try to resolve a case quicker.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think it was around 1981. I was teaching then at a small college, New College of the University of South Florida in Sarasota, Florida. And I was hired as a special consultant for a project to IBM. And they were paying me $200 an hour. And I said, my God, I said to my wife, Jan, I said, my dad would be so dumbfounded that anyone would pay me $200 an hour for anything.
Mm-hmm.
I was very, very, struck by it, and what it would have meant to my father, who alas died the day I accepted my first job, my first appointment. He didn't even know what had happened. He had a heart attack, and when he was 56 years old in 1970. And, you know, so he never even knew I had my first job. But there it was. You got so much good stuff in here, and there's a very interesting case you talk about that was seemingly an insoluble case of a fellow who was innocent. You, when you laid eyes on him, you knew he was innocent of a brutal murder and rape, as I recall. You might want to recount that for the benefit of our listeners.
Yes, that was the case of Joe White. This was a case that I was involved in briefly while I was a young attorney, fresh out of law school, and I got a request from this gentleman who was serving time in the Nebraska penitentiary. And I knew something about the case. It was a brutal rape and murder of an elderly woman in a neighboring town to Lincoln. And it was very interesting to me to go over there and meet him, because I never met anyone charged and convicted of crimes like that at that point. And so when I went over there and was able to go in and meet with him, as I was walking into the room there, the visitor's room, and I saw him, I just could not believe that he had committed any of these crimes. There's just something you know about people. And I've seen people since that I know have committed murder, and you could see it on their face and their body. You could just see it. I think you can tell when someone's killed another human being, and Joe White had not killed another human being. I could tell. And then I reviewed the records and saw how the case against him had been put together. And I saw how the witnesses at trial, one in particular who had a lot of drug problems, was a drug addict, testified she couldn't tell between her own hallucinations and the truth. And yet, based on this, they convicted him and sentenced him to life in prison. There were six defendants. Five of the other ones had taken deals and were spending time. And I knew that at least my client was not guilty. I couldn't speak to the other ones, but I knew he wasn't. But I didn't have the resources. I didn't know how to put everything together in time. And I had to leave, moved to California before I was able to complete getting anything filed for him. But I did get a call.
Yeah, from the attorney who succeeded you as his representative, and you'd actually been able to gain an acquittal. Isn't that fantastic? You must have felt so good when you learned that.
It was amazing. It was 19 and a half years that he had spent in prison, wrongfully convicted, and his other five co-defendants, the same thing. It was a little bittersweet. 2 years after he had gotten out, he was killed in an accident at work. And so all of these years that he'd been in prison, and then he only had a couple years out of freedom after that.
At least he died a free man.
That's true. That's true. And his family got to see him again, and you know. But it goes to show that the system can sometimes work, albeit very, very, very slowly.
Well, you got lots of wonderful quotes and little passages here. Helpful hacks, you call them, and so forth. Tell me, what is the conspiracy of secrets that you talk about in the book?
That's something that really has started to eat at me over time, and that is so much of what happens in the judicial system is done behind closed doors. There's no record of it. In fact, for some, there's not even a written record of it. And as there are budget cuts in court, there's even less that there's a record of. And so if there are abuses, it's hard for anybody to see. There's not that transparency.
Yeah, this is something that offends me about Obama's executive orders. After Sandy Hook, which you may or may not know, was in fact a FEMA drill, a two-day FEMA drill that was orchestrated using an abandoned school in order to fake the shooting of 20 children to promote gun control. On the 16th of January, 2013, just a month and 2 days after the event, he signed 23 executive orders on gun control. And so many of these executive orders are secret from the public. I mean, I mean, Melody, it makes no sense at all. How can a president of the United States be signing executive orders that have the status of law, and yet the public isn't allowed to know the content of those executive orders, some of which I believe, by the way, have weakened the enforcement of our border with Mexico. I think he's directed that we allow any number of Mexicans to cross the border. This is just an example. He could have done that in an executive order that people would not know. And, you know, all the border patrols, by the way, have endorsed Donald Trump. Rather interesting.
I don't know. I can't speak to those. I haven't researched that issue. But it is true that, I understand that there are certain aspects of things that need to be, have some level of secrecy or protection in some fashion. But when you get to the level that there's not basic transparency of our government, it's a problem. And, you know, when I'm talking about the judicial system, we're talking about regular routine cases that go on. And what I've been seeing in particular is that there are so many abuses going on that it's just one at a time. And so the attorneys within that case, even if they were inclined, can't really address the big picture of what's going on. And the public can't, because the public can't see all of what's going on.
Don't you think on the face of it, however, that it, from a constitutional point of view, that it's absurd for a president to have the right to write laws by way of executive order where the public does not even know the contents of those executive orders? To me, this is unconstitutional on its face.
It's problematic. It's problematic. Like I said, I'm not a constitutional expert on that sort of stuff, but I certainly, I think about a case that I handled once where there was a settlement agreement in a case that was supposed to be confidential, but it had been left in the court file, which was public record. And so some people that had interest in the case, although weren't parties to the case, had gotten a copy of it. And they were hauled into court by one of the parties to the lawsuit trying to say, oh, you should be ordered to keep this agreement confidential. And the judge kind of laughed at them and said, how can you say it has to be confidential? It affects them. It affects them. And so, you know, you have this balance in court. Settlement agreements, most settlement agreements can't be kept private if they are negotiated by the court, because of this general transparency thing that you should be allowed to see what courts are approving and so forth. And when every time you get outside of that transparency, there better be a really, really, really good reason. And I think the reasons that are given these days are not good enough. And I think Homeland Security is sort of letting those lines blur even further.
Well, very disturbing. What do you think about plea negotiation in general? Aren't they subject to abuse? I mean, in relation to the Boston bombing case, there's a mountain of evidence. I have a whole book with a dozen contributors that shows that the Boston bombing was an elaborate charade. It involved amputee actors, Hollywood blood, a smoke machine, the police on bullhorns calling out, "This is a drill. This is a drill." Tweets from the Boston Globe saying that a demonstration bomb is going to be set off during the marathon for the sake of bomb squad activities. And yet this young man, Zokhar Saranov, who had nothing to do with it, was convicted in a court of law, even though they had evidence exonerating him from the beginning, including, for example, that the FBI, as a result of its investigation, concluded that the two bombs that went off were in black nylon backpacks, and their own evidence showed photographs of the two young men, neither of whom is wearing a black nylon backpack, leading a retired professor of law, John Remington Graham, to conclude there wasn't even probable cause for an arrest, much less an indictment or a conviction at trial. I'm appalled by this, Melody. If you accept what I've described as true hypothetically, since you're not in a position to verify it for yourself, what would be your opinion of the case I just described?
Well, I think that's a huge problem, and I've seen that recently in a case in Riverside County where I actually had videotape that directly contradicted what the officer said in their police reports, and they admitted on the stand that it contradicted it, and despite that, the judge bound the case over for trial. And I was shocked. I mean, what more do you need? We had videotape of the incident.
That's appalling. That's appalling.
It's appalling doesn't even seem sufficient enough.
I know. It's grotesque. It's a horrendous miscarriage of justice. It's like at Sandy Hook. We have the specification of the police where the evacuation of what should have been some 469 other children was taking place. And at those very locations and times, we have dash cam footage showing nothing going on there, Melody, nothing. It's part of the elaborate ruse to deceive the American people about what happened at Sandy Hook. I'm just appalled by all of this. But well, would you believe, you're going to love this, would you believe out in San Bernardino, we even have the Craigslist ad for extras, where there's going to be good pay, transportation and food, some speaking roles, the call date December 1st for action on the scene on December 2nd. We have the Craigslist ad for San Bernardino.
I haven't seen any of that, so I can't speak to that. But, yeah, I all of these things need to be looked in and evaluated, and I think we've lost in our age of Twitter and Facebook and all these quick little snippets of stuff, we've lost what actually is an essential useful thing of lawyers, and that is being trained to sift through the evidence, the pros and the cons, and in a perfect world, and how the jury system should operate is that those competing points of view are put in front of average citizens and the jury to make a decision. But we don't have much of that anymore. And so then, you know, it's trial by whatever, and nobody sees all the evidence in one comprehensive package anymore. But the damage has been done often, you know.
What's your feeling about cases being decided by a judge versus a jury?
I would like to see an expanding of people using jury trials. I don't like a judge just deciding to do that. I know from being a lawyer, and I've done, you know, criminal defense in particular, there are times where strategically you want to put your bet on it just being a lawyer. But in the big picture, I think you should have more jury trials. I think that's an important constitutional right. I think people who get called for jury duty should applaud that and hope to get on a jury, because that's sort of our last buttress of rights to protect against a government overreaching, and especially in the case of criminal cases.
Yeah, very bad, very bad. I followed some cases enormously. The O.J. Simpson case, that cost me a whole sabbatical. I was so obsessed with it because Geraldo Rivera was having these brilliant programs with the best people, F. Lee Bailey and Dershowitz and all that. I mean, it was really a public service he was performing, which he lost when he became a legitimate journalist. He used to be this kind of on the edge doing really important stuff with issues that the major media would normally not consider. But since he's become a legitimate journalist, he hasn't done anything of significance since. But I love that trial. I love the discussion. I recorded them all on a VHS. I had these mountains of VHS tapes, Melody, and my daughter and wife would threaten me that if I was somehow, in their view, misbehaving, they threatened to tape over my OJ tapes.
Oh, that was a long trial. I didn't watch every minute of it, but I did follow it pretty closely. I still have the money from the bet I won on the verdict. A judge and I bet a quarter each. I thought he would be acquitted. He thought he'd be convicted. And so I have that. I still have that to this day.
Marcia left out. She omitted some of the most important evidence, including a woman who is at an intersection between Brentwood and his home. The Bronco came out of the blue. It had no lights on. OJ was yelling and screaming because there were cars in front of him on his way to get home. Marcia never introduced. This would have been the linchpin of his conviction. She didn't admit the evidence because the woman had been given $5,000, I think, by the National Enquirer to publish her story.
It's a tough call in choosing witnesses, and I will tell you there are times that I've put on witnesses. I thought they were solid. Turns out they weren't. It's a tough call. I mean, I'll be honest, it's a tough call. I do think that case went on way too long. I mean, well, if you can't prove your case in a shorter period of time, you should just move on.
Yeah, I didn't think Marcia was terribly good, but Petrocelli was brilliant when he did the civil suit, and of course he got a conviction there. Right. That was a case where the evidence was presented in a concise, methodical fashion, and it carried a lot of punch. But what was the reason why you were wagering with a judge, your side, that he would be acquitted?
Well, we just happened to be, in the same place when the jury was about to come back. And so we just placed a bet right there. I just happened to be meeting with him at the time and he had it going in chambers.
But you had a rationale or was it just guessing?
Well, just based on everything that we had seen to date, I just, you know, I think there was for me a lot of distrust of Furman in particular. I think he planted the glove. I just, the police seemed to be planting evidence as opposed to just finding it. I had some issue with that and there just seemed too many questions for it to be beyond a reasonable doubt. But in terms of the civil verdict, it's a lower standard of proof. And I think that was accurate too.
Of course. Right. Well, wasn't it obvious to you that they were pulling a fast one when they had OJ put on these latex gloves underneath what would have been skin-tight fitting gloves so that Johnny Cochran could then argue if they don't fit, you must acquit? I mean, that was contrived, Melody.
It was the setup for a perfect line. I mean, from defense standpoint, Johnny Cochran, he's awesome. I mean, it made for an awesome argument. But I don't know if that turned the case or not. For me,
it's a blatant fabrication. If you took off the latex gloves, they would have fit perfectly. Those were skin-tight gloves. They clearly fit OJ perfectly if you didn't have him put on the latex underneath them.
Well, I actually think that they probably, based on their condition, probably have shrunk some. Or there's some arguments I've seen that actually OJ's hands, because of a medical condition, had swollen up. So there were a lot of reasons. There are a lot of reasons, but it was a stunt. It was a courtroom stunt. It was a stunt.
As I see it, he had the motive, the means, and the opportunity, and then, of course, he tries to make his escape by getting on a plane and flying to Chicago. I mean, as I see it, all the evidence converged on his guilt, even though it may be the case, and this is unfortunate because police should never do that, but they were trying to help the case along. But I mean, if he actually did plant the glove, and of course one at the scene and one at OJ's home, that's a horrendous abuse of his role as a law enforcement officer.
Yes. And I think it's unnecessary. I think law enforcement officers need to abide by the law. They need to scrupulously abide by the law. Otherwise they cannot be trusted. And you need to trust them because they hold in their hands tremendous power. And so that is disturbing to me. I think they probably could have made a better case had it not been for some monkey business on the part of the police, which is unfortunate.
And then, of course, the slow speed Bronco chase, you know, that's when I was introduced. I was actually in Ann Arbor, Michigan, visiting with an old friend. Jan, his wife, and others were there. We turned on the TV, and all of a sudden we saw this weird white Bronco being followed by all these cops and we're being fed in. And my wife will never forgive me for this, where I said, "Oh no, OJ can't have done it. He's a good guy." And she turned to me and said, What do you know? And of course, after spending all this time on it, I'm utterly convinced that he did it. Did you ever see this very interesting alternative explanation that actually it had been Jason who had committed the crime, that he'd been offended because she had not shown up at the restaurant and all this? I mean, Nicole, I mean, it's ridiculous.
I haven't heard of that, but I certainly suspected that possibility.
Did you really?
Just out of gut instinct, and I didn't have any evidence or anything. I just sort of, I don't know. There's a possibility.
I think the attorney's name is Dean, but you can find it online under the YouTube entitled OJ is Guilty but Not of Murder.
Interesting.
You might enjoy it. If you got a spare hour just for a multiple-type version.
So, always interesting to check out different cases.
Tell me something about the typical load of an attorney. I mean, you have a lot of, you know, I take it a lot of cases you're working at the same time.
Yes, it depends where you work and all of that. I know like public defenders have a ridiculously high workload. They can't possibly meet their obligations, which is troublesome because they're out there defending the Constitution every day in the context of their cases. And they're always underfunded and, you know, understaffed. In terms of, you know, for me in my practice, I've had times where I had 70, 80 cases on my docket sheet. And, you know, others where it was better. I mean, it was just my practice, I wasn't working with other attorneys. And even if I had, you know, like three or four cases at a time, it can be a really burdensome load. Depends how much you get called into court, discovery, all sorts of stuff.
You're going to have a pretty good memory, are you not? I mean, if you're dealing with 70 or 80 cases, you can't get a mixed up, witnesses, defendants and all that. You got to keep it all straight, not to mention all the evidence in each case. That probably wouldn't have been a great situation for me. I'm very good on theories, you know. And I retain almost everything I read, but having 70 or 80 cases like that, I don't think that would have worked very well for me, just the way my mind works.
It's tough, and you have to have good support in terms of office and keep track of calendaring, whatever. And I did, you know, I didn't have my own practice before they had all these computer programs for calendaring and keeping track of things. So it was tough. It was tough, but yeah, in terms of like facts of the case, I've just had a gift for that. And you need to have it. You never know when you're going to need another errant fact to question a witness on or whatever.
Yes. I'm pretty good with facts and evidence for JFK, 9/11, Wellstone, Sandy Hook, the Boston bombing. But what you're doing would be a whole different matter for me. It would be a real challenge, you know.
Well, and the thing is, lawyers tend to work such long hours, and so at a certain point, and after a certain number of years of practice, it takes the edge off of that, and you're sleep-deprived and adrenal-fatigued, and it takes its toll. It really takes its toll.
And, of course, the more hours they work, the more they're paid. I love your case about the kids arguing. You're going to pay them 50 cents the longer they argue for
exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I've had attorneys come to me during case and say, oh, I hope this case doesn't settle because, you know, I need to bill all these hours. And
because we need a new roof on the house, or my wife wants that new Jag.
Exactly.
I mean, give me a break, right?
And I just don't want to be part of that. And frankly, I don't want to spend the rest of my life in front of a computer or the court or, you know, falling asleep over the books. There's more to life than that.
Is this part of the reason why you wrote this book?
Yes, it is. I actually haven't been in a courtroom since November. And it's been the first time I've had this kind of break in over 20 years of practice. And it's just really nice.
Melody, I know this is, you intend this to be kind of a practical guide for someone who's in a legal predicament. What would you advise? You know, just a hypothetical case, some kind of lawsuit. You can imagine the case is easier than I. How do they go about finding a good attorney? How can they know that they're making the right decision when they select one?
Well, you never know 100%, but there are some things that you can check, and some novel things that probably most people wouldn't ask you. One is when you are interviewing a lawyer, ask them what they do outside of their job. Because you want someone who's balanced and focused, that spends time with their family, has a hobby, because then when they're working, they're going to be focusing on your things with a higher intellectual capacity. And that's really important. Another thing is find out whether the law firm requires their associates to put in a certain number of billable hours a year. Because often there's 2,000, 2,500 billable hours required a year. And when you do the math on that, you're talking 40 plus hours of billable time every week. And billable time is a lot less than, you know, when you show up at work and when you go home. There are other requirements of things that aren't billable. And that just creates a sleep deprived state, and you're not going to get effective representation that way. You know, the smart person's going to figure out a solution and go home early.
Melody, tell me about cases where it's done on a contingency versus requiring, you know, a deposit in advance, a retainer, contingency versus retainer.
Contingency agreements are common for personal injury cases, maybe defamation, stuff like that. Because the lawyers know that the parties just don't have the money to pay them on an hourly basis. So it's kind of a bet. The lawyers are going to put in their time, their resources, Sometimes it may involve thousands of dollars in terms of expert witnesses or whatever, but they put all of that in as a bet that they're going to get paid off at the end. And if they lose the case, they don't get any money. And if you win the case, then you just be prepared. You're going to lose 30, 40, 50% of the amount because the lawyer gets to get paid. And it's expensive.
So when an attorney takes a case on contingency, that ought to be interpreted by a party hiring them that they actually believe they have a winnable case.
Yes, that or they just can't seem to stop themselves from wanting to help you. And I think that is a certain gauge because I'm one of those that's a very compassionate attorney and I want to help my clients irrespective of financial gain. But you know, you've got to keep a roof over your head, your office going. And so you need to find a fine balance there. And you, if they take it on contingency, yes, they have some belief that they can make money off of it. Yeah.
Well, in many ways, you're writing the book is your way of reaching out to other hypothetical clients to give them the best advice you can about how to go about selecting an attorney and handling their own case.
Yes. I'm trying to give people a new way of looking at things, whether they use an attorney or not, and how to evaluate the resources that are out there. For example, there are all sorts of advertisements for lawyers that are paid. That it's like if you see in a magazine, perhaps a feature on, you know, the best lawyers in, you know, whatever your geographical area is, you don't know for sure whether that was a paid for article or not. So I would sort of take that with a grain of salt. The same with websites that have rankings for attorneys. Again, that's sometimes based on how many times a person comments on something or some arbitrary classification. Kind of take those rankings with a grain of salt too. But when you're looking,
they're not necessarily objective or well-founded.
Exactly.
They could even be paid for.
Yeah. When you're looking for an attorney, obviously see if friends or family or colleagues have someone they recommend, but make sure it's someone within the specialty that you need. And sometimes you can talk to someone maybe that was a great bankruptcy attorney and they may know someone who is a good criminal defense attorney or something. But you know, that is one way also to look. But again, talk with the person, interview a couple of lawyers and see which you feel best with, because there are sort of two components. You want to have subject matter expertise. Do they know what they're talking about? But the other is you're going to be dealing with them a lot. And so hopefully it's someone that is pleasant to deal with. Otherwise you're going to be miserable.
You have a lot of very practical advice here. Here's one, a helpful hack on page 83. Never forget the disputes must eventually be resolved in one way or another. Create a reminder sheet for yourself that describes the dispute and what your position and the other party's position is. Then make weekly or monthly notations showing how much money and time you have spent and what shift in movement has been made by either side. The reason for this documentation is to help you get out of the emotions of the dispute and back to practicalities. You'll soon learn that being inflexible is just costing you a lot of money and time. That seems like very wise counsel, counselor.
Yes, I found how clients get very emotionally involved in the cases. It's easy to do. You know, you've been offended, you've been injured, whatever it is. And so you've got to have some ways of just pulling yourself out of that and getting back into that upper intellectual, analytical mindset. And this is one way that I've suggested doing that.
It seems to me many of the institutions in our society are almost impervious to any legal response. For example, my book on Sandy Hook was banned by Amazon.com less than a month after it had been put on sale. It went on 22 October, bounced on the 19 November, sold nearly 500 copies, so they couldn't be complaining about that it wasn't selling. They said I should, they never gave me any explanation, but said I should review the guidelines, but there weren't any guidelines that, so far as I can see, it hadn't satisfied. It became a rather significant issue at the time because it's so rare in this day and age that books are banned, but it was a fairly comprehensive ban. And, you know, I had to find a whole alternative publisher and distributor to get the book out, which I've now done, I'm glad to say.
I've heard that from someone else, too, so I'm very curious about that. They haven't banned me yet, but, you know, who knows? Maybe now that I've been on your show, they'll ban me.
Yeah, why lawyers suck. I mean, you know, that does invite a certain attention to a certain attitude, and they may feel you're giving the game away, you know.
I don't know.
Deprive them of income because I think you make such excellent points, and the idea. Can cases just be taken on the basis of a lump sum, you know, just so much money, regardless of the number of hours?
They can be. In fact, in California, there's now a requirement that all legal fee agreements have to contain the language that legal fees are negotiable between the client and the attorney. It's like we have to remind clients, we're required to remind clients that this is a negotiation. There aren't set fees. And you can go in there and say, no, I'm not going to pay that. I'll pay this. The attorney may not want to take your case, but that's, you know, it is negotiable. Yes, you can have flat fees. And although it's a little hard to learn how to do that, even for me that I'm really trying to do it, I have found ways. And my clients have been thrilled when I break down litigation into certain blocks of things that, yeah, I've been doing this for years. I know about how much time it will take, and I can break it down into certain blocks, and they've really liked that, and it makes me work more efficiently too. And I'm not a millionaire, so maybe I'm doing it wrong that way, but the clients are happier.
My surmise would be that there may be major differences from state to state in relation to the practice of the law. Could you comment on whether that is or is not the case?
Yes, there is. I began my practice in Lincoln, Nebraska, and I was doing criminal law. But there was just really a collegial environment there between like prosecutors and defense attorneys. I didn't see the anger and the venom, there. I didn't see it. And then I came out to California and Southern California, LA in particular, but San Diego's getting pretty bad too. There's just a certain edge and venom about cases, and I've been doing civil disputes, which, you know, involve money as opposed to maybe going to jail. The level of venom is just awful. And I'd say, you know, Southern California, especially LA, New York is bad. Chicago has some pretty bad ones as well. So yeah, it is different. It is different.
Do you think it's at all affected by the state of economy, that things, since things are kind of dismal right now economically, that there may be more focus on money by members of the profession, that if times were better, maybe there'd be less?
Yeah, I think there are too many lawyers. And because of that, it's harder to make a living as a lawyer. And now you have lawyers coming out of law school where they thought they were going to have a great job, you know, six-figure salary pretty quick out of law school, and end up having to just hang up a shingle, don't really have much mentoring and whatever, and it's cases are scarcer than they would like, and they're not getting paid as much as they'd like. And I think that creates kind of an edge and kind of a chip on everybody's shoulder, because financially it's tough for lawyers.
That's very interesting. When I finished my PhD in 1970, the job market was very different than it would have been 4 years earlier had I not served in the Marine Corps. So that, you know, those who came out with PhDs in philosophy in 1966 had typically several choices for their jobs. But those who came out in 1970, they were scarce as hen's teeth. It was really a dramatically different job market. So it's funny how, you know, circumstances can make such a huge difference. I mean, a couple of years in a profession can make all the difference in the world.
It really does. Where I went to University of Nebraska College of Law, the years before I graduated, they had placement rates of their, you know, graduating law students. Somewhere in 80-90% of students had job offers by the time of graduation. The year I graduated, I think it was around 34%. So it just dramatically different. This is in 1993, just dramatically different opportunities or lack of opportunities.
In different parts of your book, you talk about ethical issues. One course I taught on the nature of morality began by describing the difference between the legal, the moral, and the proper. Where the legal, of course, are those forms of conduct that are enforced by the state for which you can be subject to prosecution or even deprivation of life, liberty, or property if you violate them. The morality concerns treating other people with respect, never treating them merely as a means, but always, you know, respecting their rights as a human being, where classic examples of immoral conduct would include murder, robbery, kidnapping, and rape, where you're merely using other people as a means, and where it does merely as a means, where you can, of course, have perfectly moral means relationships as with employees and employers, where the employer is using the employees to run a business, make money, and produce products, and the employee is using the employer to earn an income and to make a living and so forth. And as long as it's not done in a disrespectful fashion, by an employee, for example, plugging in for hours, he's not actually performing work or stealing from the employer or other forms of abuse. And as long as the employer is paying a fair salary and not making work conditions unsafe or too long, you know, excessive work hours in an unsafe environment, it can be a perfectly moral relation, where propriety, of course, just includes manners and which fork you use when you eat a meal for your fork and so, and whether you should send a thank you note, all these things that don't really even ascend to the level of ordinary morality, but are issues of propriety or manners, good manners. And in the law, I get the feeling that there's a kind of a blurring of the distinction between the moral and the legal, and many attorneys actually don't care or are careless about whether or not they actually represent their clients in an ethical fashion.
Well, you're right. In terms of moral and legal, they are not the same thing. There are some overlaps, but they're not the same thing. And yeah, in law school, it's not about being moral. It's about understanding the law and how to argue the law. The issue of morality or that your intrinsic morality is pushed to the side. And I think, and talk about this in detail in the book, is deliberately pushed aside, especially at the end of the first year when you're exhausted and you're being told that you need to argue this position that you don't agree with. And they pick a case for you to argue that, and you have to be prepared to argue both sides, that they're going to get you one way or another, having to prepare an argument that you do not believe in. And I think it changes you. I think it changes how you interact with the world after that. And there are pros and cons to it. You kind of need to set aside some things in order to have that intellectual edge that you need to practice the law. But I think you lose something in that day that you argue something that you vehemently do not agree.
You become
with.
A hired gun.
You do. You do.
You know, I mean, a perfect example is slavery, which is immoral, if anything is immoral, because you're just using another person merely as a means. We have these graphic cases of ISIS, you know, kidnapping a bunch of girls, for example, to turn them into sex slaves. That's all grossly abusive. Well, slavery was legal in the United States at some point and illegal at other points, which shows you can have a clear conformity or violation of the principles of morality by the law, because slavery was always immoral, and yet it was sometimes legal and other times illegal.
Correct. And you have ones that depends on who you ask. For example, with the whole issue with alcohol in our history is the same way. Used to be that was legal, then not legal, then legal again. And for some people, that's always been a moral issue. So, yeah.
Prohibition. Yeah, absolutely right.
Right.
In fact, many of sociologists have observed that prohibition led to the creation of organized crime, because people had something they wanted. They didn't think it was immoral to have it, namely consumption of alcohol as a beverage. And the mob supplied it, where the government created an absurd situation, which we then replicate with marijuana, Melody. What is it going to be more stupid than these laws against marijuana? You know? Just because a generation prefers to smoke its high instead of drink it?
I think marijuana should be dealt with on a scientific basis and somewhat of a social basis, in the sense that I have never, ever heard of someone smoking a joint and then going home and beating their wife.
Right.
With alcohol, you know, that is rampant. And so I think we've got to be really honest about the fact that we legalize alcohol, we legalize tobacco with restrictions, which there should be, but I don't see why marijuana doesn't fall within that same category of these are vices that we allow under certain restrictions.
I'm personally convinced the liquor industry has been concerned with propping up the war on drugs and keeping marijuana illegal because they don't want the competition. Actually, marijuana, in my experience, is a far superior high. You feel mellow. You know, if more people were smoking more joints, we'd have less wars, less domestic violence. I like your illustration. Never hearing of someone who smokes a joint and then beats their wife. That's very good. Very apt. Very apropos.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, alcohol can be just the opposite. Yeah, people go wildly out of control.
Yeah, it is demonstrated, documented, problematic in terms of social unrest. And marijuana does not have that history. And so, you know, I've never tried it. I don't intend to, but I don't see that I am damaged by someone else smoking marijuana privately in their own home. I don't see that it's damaging me.
Yeah, in my day and age, I think if you had never smoked a joint, you just weren't there.
Well, you know, the first drug.
I never smoked a lot, but when I was living in Lexington, Kentucky, I had friends there. And, of course, Kentucky is a great tobacco state. We also had very good marijuana, and, you know, I mean, occasionally I had a joint, but I certainly never thought there was anything wrong about what I was doing, even if it happened to be illegal by the state, which was just one of those incongruities where many laws, it seems to me, are set up to benefit particular institutions, corporations, and special interests.
Well, I do tend to think with marijuana, I see the shift that's going on in the country, and I see there are states where it's been legalized. I've seen how business has seen the financial potential of marijuana, and so I think it's just a matter of time until that's going to be legalized.
Business and government, because they get
and government too can tax that
benefits from, you know, in Colorado.
It's much better. It is much more efficient for the country to regulate and tax than to keep maintaining the drug war.
You're sending out your police on these trivial non-victim crimes of people who are smoking their high instead of drinking it. I mean, it's ridiculous. And you're criminalizing a major segment of the population that otherwise would be productive workers who are paying taxes. Instead, they become burdens of the state, and we have to pay maybe an average of $100,000 a year to incarcerate them for a crime when they could be producing taxable income for the state.
I looked up the stats recently, and I probably want to double check these, but I believe we have twice as many people incarcerated as China does. And you got to ask why. I mean,
we need
other people behind bars.
Yeah, the population of China is, what, five times that of the United States?
Yeah, and so why? Why are we putting all these people in jail?
Something very wrong with our society. Let me ask you about this, because, you know, there's been this move to the privatization of prisons. I think that's a calamitous blunder. You got people who want to have more prisoners because they're getting more work out of them and making more profits. I think it's a just colossal abuse of the system, very un-American, very undemocratic, and wrong.
I agree. I agree from a moral and legal standpoint. I think when you make incarceration of human beings a for-profit endeavor, you're going to continue to create crime because there's a benefit in it. And there shouldn't be a benefit in crime. There never should be a benefit in crime to anybody. It should be something that the government needs to deal with. And we need to deal with that in as best a fashion that we can. But, you know, if your prisons are overcrowded, and, you know, there have been plenty of decisions on this, you got to let some of those people go. And I think the solution is not building bigger prisons. What needs to be done is be more selective on who we're sending to prison in the first place.
Right. Fewer prisons because fewer prisoners, because we're dealing with our fellow citizens in a more constructive fashion.
Exactly. More constructive is the key, yeah.
Would there be one case or another that was of special anxiety to you or special gratitude? You know, say one very successful case versus one where things just didn't work out that you'd care to share even in the abstract?
Well, I know there was one. I once did a child custody case that involved a six-year-old boy and what family member he was going to live with. And it was very intense, and I knew how much was at stake for this six-year-old, and we won the case, which I believe largely was because of the testimony that this boy gave in chambers to the judge, just very honest about his observations. And I felt so grateful when we were done with that case. I've never done another custody trial since then because I couldn't lose. I couldn't lose. It would just devastate.
The process worked the right way in that case.
It did. It did.
Any cases you just regret? I mean, you mentioned the White case, but that turned out to have a positive solution, even though you personally weren't able to bring it about.
One that still haunts me is a recent one that is not resolved, and that is of Dr. David Dortch up in Riverside County. And he was targeted by the Riverside County law enforcement and prosecutors. And I don't entirely know why, but we do have an email from a law enforcement officer to all the city employees telling them not to do business with this family. They investigated them, and it because of their political beliefs. That was the wording that's in there. They were targeting because their political beliefs, which was not, they're not, they weren't people who went out there and talked to everyone.
First Amendment violation.
Absolutely. But it just, they had the power and ability to just make things
miserable
over and over and over again, to the point that my clients, I represented the whole family actually, decided to leave town, I guess. They didn't tell me their decision, but they've been missing since November. I don't know where they are, and I certainly hope that they are safe. But the system failed them, absolutely failed them, and that kind of haunts me.
Well, Melody, you haven't failed your readers because you've written a wonderfully readable, informative, very practical book. Where can people obtain a copy?
Well, on Amazon, if you want to do business with Amazon. If you don't, you can just send a check directly to me, $20, to Legal Greenhouse. The address is 4010 Sorrento Valley Boulevard, Suite 400, San Diego, California, 92121. Or you can look on www.legalgreenhouse.com. The address is on there as well. And I'm happy to send you a copy direct, or you can buy it on Amazon.
Let me reiterate, that's legalgreenhouse.com. I think that's probably the easiest way to retain it. Melody, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. You've been a terrific guest, and I think your book is going to do a lot of people a lot of good. Why Lawyers Suck. Very funny, Melody. I can't thank you enough.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guest, Melody Kramer, for being here, and all of you for watching.
Hi, my name's Gary King, and aside from being a programming director for several networks and hosting a JFK show with Dr. James Fetzer, there is another side to me that I'd like to share. I'm a musician and have an acoustic album out that is completely all acoustic instruments. I've got Earl Ciano, one of the most prominent keyboard players in New Orleans. We've got Greg Finsley as New Orleans as it gets. So if you want to hear something that is absolutely not mainstream music, it is completely independent label, then it's Gary King, Sometimes Less Is More. So here's a cut off my acoustic album, and then our band Swamp, which is about to release a new album. So stay tuned. So here's a cut off the acoustic album called Whales. Thank you. All right, just say or type into your phone, Gary King, Sometimes Less is More on iTunes. It'll pop right up. And support true independent music.